Today is Saturday, August 29th. I am Linda Lenski, and I am interviewing the third interview with Jane Roe. Last time we talked, we left off right before Jane was going to describe her second marriage, and that's where we're going to pick it up today. Here's Jane.
Hello again. I fell in love in 1975. But I think I was as much in love with AA as with the man I ultimately married, name of Ben, who was an old-timer in AA, 24 years, who was who also carried the rather romantic aura of having been a World War II vet. I was a kid in fourth grade when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. He was in high school, being that much older than I, and was one of the younger surviving war veterans, did actually fight in the infantry in the South Pacific, and that still had held some romantic aura for me from my days of growing up in the shadow of World War II. And of course, he represented the culture of older men that really hauled me into safety in AA, and I was devoted to them. I think in love with the whole thing. It was AA was exciting and romantic, and P.S., it saved my life. And along came Ben, who sort of represented all that. So I fell head over heels in love with this kind of unlikely-looking little Irishman who was very witty, very funny, very, very smart, not very educated. He had to drop out of high school just before graduation because he didn't have a suit or shoes to wear to graduation. He grew up with a schizophrenic mother and an alcoholic father and was passed along for most of his growing up years to a very, very impoverished but pleasant family in South Dakota. They didn't abuse him. They just didn't have much to give him except cardboard for his shoes. And so he had to sort of take off on his own when he could. And after he dropped out of high school, he signed on for the Army and had been married for many years to a woman who brought three children to the marriage, and they were fairly successfully reared. Well, mixed success. One was still a practicing alcoholic, I guess. But he was in the last phase of a disintegrating marriage when I met him, or so he assured me. And I was naive and in love with AA, and I took to him in a great way, and we began to date. And he seemed to have plenty of time. He worked for Bureau of Alcohol and Other Drugs and was on the road all the time. And so I got him most weekends. And that was fun. I had a room in the basement of our house, and the boys were upstairs. He was very pleasant with the boys and was to become a very good stepfather. And we just immersed ourselves together in a culture. Ultimately, getting married mostly because my parents were uncomfortable with us living together. I had been disinterested in relationship. I was really very asexual the first year or so of my recovery. My body was in such poor shape, I think I just wasn't firing on all my cylinders. But once the libido came back, it came back in spades, and Ben was pretty terrific in bed, lots of practice, and as it turned out, more than I had in mind. And so that was very satisfying. And I realized, thinking about it this morning, that AA at that time, particularly in Madison, was a very, very heterosexual culture. We never said the L word in meetings. Nobody ever said the gay or homosexual words. If you were gay, you concealed it as much as possible. I didn't think of myself as gay. I thought of myself, as I long had, as bisexual, and it seemed like sort of a non-issue, especially while I was in love with a man. And it was a very couplish thing socially. We had a heterosexual group of friends that we did stuff with. Potlucks and parties of all kinds. I remember a Halloween party where we both went as street people, and we looked pretty terrific. I have a picture of us at some time. We were very convincing. Both had a little practice, I think, in that role. And it was fun. And the other thing we did together, which was just a blast, was ride motorcycles. Cause as soon as I started to feel better physically, I missed the excitement that drinking had provided before I got into maintenance drinking, and all the excitement was negative. It was fear and apprehension and paranoia and all those unpleasant emotions, which I suppose are a form of excitement, but none that we volunteer for. And so the motorcycle thing was wonderful. Ben and I learned together. Actually, I had an easier job than he did because I had ridden bicycles and mopeds for years. Poor old Ben had never owned a bicycle, and so when I encountered him, he was trying to learn to ride a motorcycle on a great big huge Honda 750 or something, a tall machine, way too tall for him and way too powerful. And he would appear all battered and bruised and say his Honda had thrown him again. It was kind of as if he were trying to tame a wild stallion. I finally persuaded him to buy us a nice little modest 250, whatever it was, I don't even, some little Jap, a Suzuki, that's what it was. And we both practiced on it and had a mentor who was an old friend of Ben's, who was a longtime motorcyclist, and taught us one valuable thing that all motorists are out there trying to kill us, which is a very good thing for a motorcyclist to keep in mind. And that was probably the greatest bond Ben and I had besides sex for years and years. We had wonderful times on our motorcycles. He was working all week, would come home for the weekend, or I would meet him someplace on my motorcycle, usually someplace like Eau Claire, where he and his work partner would have been working all week on establishing employee assistance programs, the replacement for the old alcoholism programs. And we had a sort of terrific, I think in retrospect, rather adolescent time. But the boys worked well with it. Chris was, he helped Chris get a job, my middle son get a job as a motorcycle mechanic while he was still in high school, and that was a great success. I actually taught Chris to ride a motorcycle, which he will not admit to this day. And he actually rode around behind his mother for a few times, and he definitely will not admit that. And we had a great time with that. We, when we were persuaded to get married, we went to the Smokies on our motorcycles, and it was really quite a ghastly ordeal because by then I had a huge touring bike, a Kawasaki 650 with a lot of power, and which weighed 530 pounds, and I spent most of my honeymoon in a state of advanced terror because it was raining, and it was mountain driving, which I had never done much of even in a car, and it was not fun. I remember that I had to sort of unwrap my hands every night off the handlebars because I would have been so tense that they froze on the handlebars, and I would have this sort of pseudo-arthritis into the night from clenching the handlebars so tightly. But aside from that, it was quite a lot of fun. So we embarked on marriage in this spirit of fun, but ultimately, of course, it became something else, as marriages tend to do. They either steady out in a nice way or wobble a lot, and this one wobbled a lot because Ben got into health problems. He took very poor care of his body. He didn't exercise. His standard food while on the road was a cheeseburger with French fries. He got atherosclerosis. He had intermittent claudication in his legs and ultimately had something that they finally decided was a stroke, but at the time didn't recognize. I was motorcycling up to meet him in Eau Claire and found him in ICU. And after that, he had to take retirement for health reasons. And that was a disaster because that meant that he was home all day on his own schedule. And his idea of that was to nap a lot and loaf a lot. And he never did a thing around the house anyway. And then to watch television late into the night in our bedroom, which was not a happy arrangement. A, I don't care for television. B, I need my sleep. So I got crabbier and crabbier. And Ben, unbeknownst to me, started, reverted to his old type. I was slowly learning. I was not quick to catch on because of my romantic notions about old timers in AA, that Ben was assiduous in his practice of steps 1, 2, 3, and 13, 13 being the womanizing step, or in the case of lesbians and gays, other sex seeking step. And he reverted to that, and a misguided sponsee of mine decided to do a ninth step with me by talking about her sexual relationship with Ben, which sort of blew our marriage out of the water. We had to take one more long trip together by motorcycle after that, out to Portland, because we had a very close friendship with an Episcopal priest and his wife who had worked with us on the Bishop's Alcoholism Committee. Ben and I were both Episcopalians at the time, and we'd been very much involved in that. We'd run a workshop for a bunch of priests on alcoholism to help them with their counseling and things of that sort. So we went out to see Ken Truman and his wife, and I remember the whole trip being a ghastly ordeal. In fact, I rode along behind Ben on my motorcycle wishing he'd fall off and die most of the way. I was so sick of the whole thing, I just wanted out. It was just, it was end of an illusion, you know, it was crash. I'm glad that I didn't throw the big baby AA out with the bathwater, which was Ben, because I wasn't disillusioned with AA per se. I was just disillusioned with his practice of it and with his unfaithfulness in marriage. And I've always been a serial monogamist, but I've pretty much been a monogamist, so I was not tolerant of that behavior. And this was before all the concern about AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases and things. It was just the feeling that you can't be successfully intimate with more than one person. And I still adhere to that deep in my spirit. So anyway, part of that marriage terminating neatly from my point of view, was that at the same time I managed to be falling in love with a woman who was working with me on the school committee. I think we called ourselves Women's History Curriculum Committee. And she was a lesbian too, of course, and as were a couple other members of the committee. But we were all ardent feminists, and we worked very, very hard. We inserted a lot of good feminist stuff. Pretty ordinary stuff when you think back on it, but just, you know, gender substitution, screening textbooks for sexist stuff, being sure that when they showed a picture of firefighters, there were women in it, and just that kind of ordinary stuff that now seems like what happens, but in those days it was not what happened. I went on the road with a roadshow for librarians, with bringing books from my own collection, showing the horrors of a book about prehistoric people, which always showed cave men in the forefront of the picture and cave women sort of lurking in the shadows with a cooking pot somewhere. Books about scientists, which would have one token woman scientist, always, of course, Madame Curie, and so on and so forth. I had a great array of books, and I put on a dramatic presentation, slamming them to the table as I scoffed at each one, and I was trying to put that lens on them permanently, because these were the people who reviewed books, movies, film strips, all media for the system, and they were significant, and we also had quite an impact on textbook selection. And this other woman, Marcia, was as passionate about it as I. And again, I'm not sure I fell so much in love with her as with our mutual cause, but the combination was potent. And with my disillusionment with Ben, and hence with yet another man who fell way short of the mark, that became a really intense romantic thing. I moved in with her. I left Ben in my house because he didn't have another place to live, and moved in with her, and there began a very unsuccessful one-year relationship. She had no garden. She was no kind of gardener. She had a few bulb plants. She was either allergic to dogs or to the idea of dogs, I'm not sure which, had no cats, had a group of friends she'd had forever, who were nice people. I liked her friends, but I was in a funny situation. I didn't have a lot of lesbian friends of my own because I'd lived in this heterosexual society for quite a while, and Elth and I were somewhat distant by then. She was never very fond of Ben and vice versa, and that balance had been badly, and she wasn't very fond of my being sober because we were drinking buddies and she was my enabler, and our relationship canoe had come on very heavy water, and it was some time before we got that at all mended. So I had Marcia's friends, Marcia's gardenless tiny house, and no animals, and we did have in common women's music and a really fun volleyball team. Some of the women on that team are still friends of mine, not too surprisingly, in the AA program, and we called ourselves the Laughing Sox, and we were probably the worst volleyball team in the league, but we had a terrific time. Two present Phi Ed teachers joined our team, and they said, this is not a volleyball team, it's a social organization. They taught us a few of the finer points of the game, like how to make a successful serve and things like that. But that was fun that we had. Oh, Marcia also didn't like my motorcycle. She was terrified when I rode it, so that wasn't any fun, and it just wasn't much fun. The culminative disaster was that the one thing we did have in common was women's music, which was in its roaring, well, not quite infancy, it was beyond that, but it was the era of Meg Christian and Chris Williamson and all the early greats, and the music festival was in its fledgling years. I think it was due for its about third year. It was on the new land, whatever year that represented, and I was dying to go, and Marcia professed herself as being eager to go and then backed out at the last minute. Well, that was the death knell. I went off to the music festival by myself, well, without her, with a good friend of hers who had become a good friend of mine, and we had a terrific time, but it was, I had a realization the whole time that our relationship was over, over, over. And so I had to embark on an awkward period where I was essentially homeless. I wasn't going to move back in with Ben. I wasn't going to kick him out into the street. And I wasn't going to take up with Marcia again. So I stayed with a friend until we got to the point where I could reclaim my own little house on Farley Avenue and so on. So that was the end of marriage two, lesbian relationship two. And I was on my own for a while, and it was quite a lot of fun, actually. It felt good to be free in that world. I was well connected by then in the lesbian world, and had a circle of lesbian friends, one of whom asked me to look out for a woman who was not very far into recovery and was going to be on her own in Madison, to which she was rather new, over Christmas and New Year's. And this mutual friend was afraid she might get into trouble just by virtue of her loneliness. And I said, well, that's okay. I was thinking about having a New Year's Eve party anyway. I'll have that. She can come, and that'll be something to look forward to, and I'll have a bunch of lesbians. So I had a New Year's Eve party, and it was a lot of fun, but it was kind of hilarious because everyone was in recovery. So, you know, by about 11:30, we were all struggling to stay awake. At about 3 minutes to 12, we were all holding our breath collectively. And at about 12:03, everyone fled, and I was so glad because I was dying to go to bed. But it worked. This woman stayed sober and so forth. And, well, that woman turned out to be Vig, with whom I was to have a subsequent housemate relationship and so on. The biggest significance of Vig in my life, the biggest positive significance, was that she was somewhat connected to Lizards, a group of lesbians over 40 who met in various women's homes. And I had not been a part of that with Marcia. We had a very different social circle. So she suggested that we go to that I branch out somewhat beyond the recovering lesbian circle. That was my natural milieu. So we agreed to go together to the next Lizard. And she said she had a friend, a retired school teacher in Janesville, who would meet us and take us to this house in McFarland where we were supposed to meet. So we took my car and we met this woman in that restaurant, what is it, Maple Leaf or Maple Tree or something, on the edge of McFarland. And the minute she stepped out of her car to meet us, my heart leapt, because this was a very, very attractive older woman. Chiseled features, mannish haircut, beautiful steel gray hair, great light in her eyes, bouncy walk. She was really something to note. And fortunately, it was snowing a bit, and visibility was a little obscured, and so she wasn't as sure of her way as she thought. So she drove ahead of us and hopped out at every streetlight to look at the street signs with her flashlight, and I got to admire her for several stops all the way. I think by the time we got to the house, I was extremely interested in this woman. But then I found out you had to take a number and get in line in order to talk to her, because her approach to parties was not the schmoozing around kind of thing, but she addressed a person at a time so she could really listen and really be heard. Mostly listen. She was a skilled listener. And when I finally got to her, I interviewed her extensively in my old newspaper reporter way, and my interest heightened even more. I learned something about her life in Janesville, something about her background and so forth, and I found that her birthday was just before mine and coming up fast, that she was March 22nd and I was March 25th, and that she was just about to leave on a downhill skiing trip. Downhill skiing. Oh, this woman, by the way, was 71, leaving on a downhill skiing trip with her daughter to Colorado, which I thought was pretty neat for a 71-year-old. And so I thought, after the party successfully concluded and we drove home, I thought, well, what could be more natural than a birthday card? So I sent B a birthday card to greet her on her arrival back home, and included my telephone number two or three times, I think. And my sense was that she had barely unpacked before she called me up, so the interest was reciprocal. And she didn't just say, let's get together sometime. She said, why don't you come down to Janesville next weekend and have dinner with me and bring your overnight bag? I have a guest room. And I thought, yee-hoo! So I think I carried my pack bags to school that day. I was very eager to get down to Janesville, and the boys were independent by then, and I didn't have household obligations. They were taking care of their own dogs and so on. So I shot down to Janesville and had a lovely pork chop meal and carried on with interviewing and being interviewed. And we sat together on the couch, and all of a sudden she turned to me and said, "I think if I don't kiss you pretty soon, I'm going to die." Mm. And I said, "I think I might too." So that was the beginning of an incredibly highly charged romance, which stayed highly charged for 11 years until the day of her death. It was, it was great. It was, don't ask me why, but it was just absolutely great. We had many things not in common, much history not in common. She was a natural athlete. I was a klutz. She thought my sports history was a riot. She was much more agile and athletic. I didn't particularly care for most of her friends who were an older lesbian set who were very closeted. They were kind of out of the Boston marriage era, and whose idea of a really good time was to meet for the Super Bowl game and bet, and forget it. They were kind of interesting women in their own way. They were professionals. One was a psychiatrist, one head of physical therapy someplace, one, they were all, except that Vidge was part of this, all very successful women and quite good professional role models, but as lesbians, I didn't find them terribly interesting. They were, I guess, sort of dated, and their relationships felt staid by comparison with ours, except for one. There was one couple one worked for corrections, and one was a lawyer who was to become a sort of judge, and they had a very interesting relationship with a very interesting history, and I enjoyed that a lot. But mostly this wasn't a company I cared to keep very much. But despite that, we made friends. And then we embarked on this intergenerational household with Vera Jean and her mother. And that started out as a very useful, helpful, supportive lesbian environment, but where we could have a lot of friends in, make a circle of mutual friends. But it was ultimately eroded and then destroyed by difficulties between Vidge and I, which were for which I subsequently realized she was probably not culpable. It was a problem with addiction. She was also ostensibly a recovering alcoholic, but I learned that her recovery was not complete by any means. I mean, she wasn't really into recovery, and that she had a personality disorder, which was beyond my coping. And so the last couple of years of that were hell. This was compounded by the fact that my youngest son came down with a really nasty form of cancer, which it took a year and a half to diagnose and then another year and a half to fix. And so I had to be dealing with that a lot. I was the core of his support system, which largely consisted of taking him to Methodist Hospital in the night for emergency room treatment because they didn't know what to do with him. He had horrible pain, and they didn't know how else to treat him than to fill him with morphine and wrap him in warm blankets. And it was carcinoid cancer, and they know more about it now, but they didn't know much then. A couple of long trips to Mayo, and B was just wonderful. She was a stalwart. She couldn't have been more supportive. She took care of my dog and my cat. She held down the household and did my work as well as hers. And one of Vidge's less charming traits was that she never did anything around the house except mow the lawn, which was pretty seasonal. And I did all the cooking and shopping and so on, and Bea did all the household maintenance and other lawn stuff, and I did all the gardening and so on. We also paid for nearly everything but the basic mortgage, so it was an imbalance, but Bea managed to cope with that too, so she did very well, and we came out of that okay, but it was definitely a big stressor. So. And it got to the point where I was going to school to work and coming home and having to just stop and breathe, stop halfway home and try to meditate and do program AA practices just to face the household, because it was so difficult to walk into what I would be walking into, which was usually some sort of violent rage. It was very, very uncomfortable. Vidge had the habit of making these long lists of grievances and saving them up and then saying, "I want to talk to you," and my heart would sink. And then she would smile and say, "You know," she referred to her last roommate, used to say, "I kept laundry lists, and I guess that's what this is." And I said, "Well, it's dirty laundry, and I'm sick of it, and I'm not going to do this anymore." So I quit turning up for these appointments and ultimately said, "I can't live here anymore, B." And she said, "Well, I can't. I haven't got another move in me." So at that point, I lived with a friend again till I could find a house. Well, actually, I moved in with Elf, Only Elf and Bob would take me with a Newfoundland dog and a cat, but I did that till I found a house. And in 1989, I was house hunting, and a gay friend called a gay man I had met on some, we had a gay sectional at teacher's convention, and I think I knew him from that. And he said, "Stop house hunting." He said in his sweet queenly way, "I have a place for you." And that turned out to be this house where we're sitting right now. And I had to persuade the owner of it to sell it. He had it in mind to sell it, but not right then. He'd fallen in love and wanted to move in with his partner, but they also wanted to house their parents over here part of the time. So anyway, I bought this house. And so B and I had a very different kind of relationship then in terms of physical space, but interestingly enough, it worked pretty well. It had its moments because she had her involvement in that household that had become such anathema to me. But she was with me at least every other night and virtually every weekend, and we traveled together, and it worked pretty well. She was a person who was always involved in projects. She was always doing something in the house, restoring a retaining wall or pouring a sidewalk or something strenuous. And I had a big job. I was very, very busy at work, and some separate friends, teaching colleagues and so on. So it worked admirably well. In some ways may have kept us from getting sort of stayed and sought in our ways as a couple, because when we were together, we had fun together. We deliberately made especially good use of the time, and we had a lot of friends in common by then and a lot of interests in common, and we both enjoyed the same kind of travel, lots of camping and motel travel, and we had our little rituals. The Easter Bunny had always to follow us on trips, so I always pretended that I concealed, I'm sure I didn't, all kinds of chocolate Easter eggs and fuzzy rabbits and chickens and things, and then the surprise Easter Bunny would find us in a motel or campground, and that kind of dumb stuff that you do when you're in love and it's fun. And and so we got along very amiably for what came to 10 years. And then on February 22nd, 1994, I got a call at school that B had been taken to the emergency room, that she had had a stroke that morning, not too long after I left for school. And so my principal, who knew B because she'd been a volunteer at my school and, like everyone else, liked her a lot, said, "Go, don't worry about the library, don't worry about anything, just go." So I was amazed at his compassion and understanding, because I thought he was sort of a dodo otherwise, but he was great. And so I shot off to the emergency room, and there was B, pretty essentially unconscious and in not very good shape, as one is right after a massive stroke, and that no particular prognosis. They told me that it was not a time when you could tell what would happen. And the nurse embarked on asking me questions about B. One thing I appreciated almost immediately was that this was Madison General, or was it Meritor by then? Doesn't matter, same hospital. They gave me spousal treatment right there, and I think only in Madison, perhaps, would they have done that. They didn't send for her daughter, Pennsylvania. They asked me, and a lot of questions about her life. And one of them was, "Is she a smoker?" And I said, "Not anymore." And the nurse snorted and then said, "Why was there a pack of cigarettes and a lighter in her bathrobe pocket when we got her?" And I said to B, who was unconscious, "B, when you wake up, I'm going to hit you with a baseball bat," because she had told me she'd quit smoking, but she was still sneaking cigarettes, and probably a lot of them the day she was living over at the other house. And I'm sure that was a factor in her maintaining separate quarters, too. She must have really suffered when we were on trips. I don't know how she got through that. Probably in the park bathrooms at night, I don't know, but anyway. So we embarked on a very different kind of year. B, at the hospital, we had very gracious treatment. We had a doctor in common who loved us both, who wept because B had had a stroke, who wept again when B had a heart attack that complicated the stroke, who was fierce in her protection of us as a couple and told everybody, right from the cleaning woman to the neurologist who interviewed us, that we were a couple. She's now a regional director of PFLAG. I was to learn why she was so fiery in her protection of us, but she was great and paved the way for very, very continuing gracious and spousal treatment of us, which was lovely. Made a lot of things possible that might not have been. And B was ultimately discharged to a nursing home, half paralyzed, and embarked on a lot of physical therapy that was the rationale for the nursing home, because they did have a skilled PT staff. And so we had a very strenuous time, very strenuous for me and for her. Her physical therapy was hard, hard, hard. And despite her great resolve and her previous physical success at everything, she'd been a great athlete, she could not walk, and she could not walk, and she could not walk. And then when she had another heart attack, it set her back so badly that, well, Medicare signed off on her because they won't keep paying if you don't make progress. Her nursing home room was costing $5,000 a month, and it was getting pretty difficult. And I said, Bea, you need to come back and live at my house. And that's when I built the 48-foot ramp that's still out in front. I was able to take her out for weekends and things. The PT staff taught me to transfer her from car to wheelchair and back, and I could manage those things, and so I figured I could manage at home. So she moved in this house with me, and I set up the back bedroom. We had a hospital bed provided by my daughter's then partner through Dave Clarenbach. It was the bed that Kay Clarenbach, a feminist icon in Wisconsin, had used prior to her death, and it had all kinds of lovely automatic features that we could never have afforded. And Dave, through Mary Alice, loaned it to us for the duration of Bea's life, and it was quite wonderful to have back there, because it could automatically reel her up in bed, and it had a Ripley thing that kept her circulation going, and it was just quite a wonderful bed. And we always called it the Kay Clarenbach Memorial Bed, and Bea savored that. And I put a mirror up at the foot of the bed so she could watch birds out of the window. We had a feeder in the window, and I got daycare for her, and I was her PM and night nurse. And it was very, very strenuous, but it was a very loving time in our relationship, and I found it, even as she began to sort of lose it mentally, as she would always watch football games, and I would read beside her, and I would sense that she didn't really know or care who was playing. If they were wearing uniforms and passing a ball of the right shape, then it was okay. She was comfortable. It was just kind of like comfort sport, you know. And we were just happy being in the same room together and being able to touch, and it was fine. And but she began to fade away. Her mind faded, and friends came to call, and it, were aware that they were saying goodbye one by one, and it became very apparent. Thanksgiving dinner was sort of a kick. I had a woman named Jean living in the basement. We made a big Thanksgiving dinner, and Bea insisted that she participate in it, which was a bit challenging as she was totally bedridden and paralyzed on one side, but we concluded she could pretty much make a pumpkin pie. So she beat up the pumpkin with the egg, sort of, with another hand on hers, mine. And she was very proud of the pie that emerged. And we had this lovely Thanksgiving dinner, which we set up in her bedroom, the three of us. And she started eating and then threw it up all over the table. Fortunately, this woman had a lot of nursing home experience and was just great. And we all just chuckled and packed up. And later on, she and I ate Thanksgiving dinner, and Bea said she'd had enough. And we were told by an old friend who was a hospice nurse that had been in her working days, that probably Bea wasn't assimilating anything by then anyway, that it didn't really matter what she ate. She said, whatever you feed her, you're doing for you, so that you feel you're nurturing her. And so she was just having various kinds of canned soup, which I would put through a blender so that they wouldn't have any difficult chunks in them and so on. But we found quite good daycare, and it was. And one very touching thing happened, I thought. A male nurse who had some responsibility for Bea when she was in the nursing home and liked her very much and liked me, said as we checked out of the nursing home, you might have trouble with this sometimes, Jane. Don't hesitate to call me. I will come over. And he just volunteered that. Mm. And another good nursing home experience was a woman who just sort of took to us. She was an aide, and she started spending time in her room, and then she started telling us that she was a transgender person. And so she identified with us as lesbians. And she told us her whole history, and she was ideally suited for nursing home work, because although a woman in most of her appearance, she was tall and had very strong shoulders and was very good at all the lifting required and so on. And turned out she had been the first sexual reassignment surgery when the University of Wisconsin was doing that, and had a very interesting history, and had even for a while gone around to high schools and talked about her history, which we thought was pretty cool. And she brought newspaper articles, and she became a longtime friend. In fact, I saw her on the street the other day. Usually I wave and holler when I see Terry. And so we were blessed, because While B was in the nursing home, supplies were, nursing homes are not fun. They're really hard to live with. This profit motive makes them very difficult. And the food was bad. I always tried to take B other food. And Terry taught me how to steal supplies and store them in a hidden place so that we always had enough. I mean, would you believe, B was incontinent, of course, and they didn't have enough of those pads, those chucks that they put under. Mm-hmm. So I would have to steal them. They never had bibs for meals by the time they got to her. And I did all of her preparation for bed, most of the aid work for her, except when Terry was there for days, because they'd have one poor aide trying to get 26 people ready for bed. It was just ridiculous. They were always understaffed. So she really got much better care once she got here. But good care notwithstanding, Bee faded away, and on the morning, ironically, exactly a year, precisely a year, in the morning of February 22nd, 1995, I found that B was no longer drawing Beth. And the woman then living in the basement had been the nurse's aide and came up with her stethoscope and said, nope, she's gone, Jane. And so she died beside me. I mean, I was on the supervisory bed up high beyond hers. And it felt very sad and like a very good sad thing, because I had seen her through to her last partially conscious moments, and she had died an easy death and with great love, and it felt like a very successful conclusion to a very successful relationship. And I cherish that memory, that it began well and ended very differently, but very well. It was a good finish. And the women's community, the lesbian community, and particularly the recovering lesbians community, rallied around, and we had a very nice, much more conventional sort of memorial service at Bee's church, which was the big Unitarian Frank Lloyd Wright church up on University Bay Drive. And I had by then a pleasant relationship with her minister, Michael Schooler, who was very good with Bee. He was an old farm boy, and they used to talk old farm things when he came to see her. And he conducted a very nice memorial service, and we all told Bee stories. There were lots of Bee stories. People whom I had never known, who had taught with her years ago or been to her summer camp or came out of nowhere when they saw her obituary, and it was quite a crowd, and there were wonderful stories. And then we had a lesbian memorial thing here, which I'm sure you attended, and people told a story and put a candle in the sand bucket, and we had 50 people in this house, which was much smaller in those days. It had not been expanded as it is now, and people gave me gifts of money, which was wonderful, because Bee's daughter, who didn't like me very much anyway, was also a procrastinator and had not paid up the bills for daycare and so on, and I had been responsible for them, and I was beyond flat broke. I was in the hole. I was borrowing money to eke out, so the gifts from lesbian friends tided me through that difficult period until Pat finally paid me back, and then I was able to buy a garden bench in Bee's memory from the money and put it to more proper use, but it sure was a big help at the time. And I felt the warmth of the support all around me. And then I lived in a great sense of community as a single woman. I felt very much a part of the community. WISH was well established by then. One of the things that Bee and I participated in together was the establishment of Women's Space at Apple Island. We helped scrape and paint and do all the stuff that made an old factory into a women's space. And this women's support group based on, it was 12-step recovery group, but it was generic recovery based on something we learned about generic recovery at the Women's Music Festival. Started having meetings in this lovely space at Apple Island. We alternated weeks, as you will remember, AA 1 week and Al-Anon 1 week for format, but it was, and grew an increasingly large crowd, because there wasn't really a comfortable home for couples and for either AA's, AA lesbians or Al-Anon lesbians out in the world. And we had, I don't know, very often 22 to 30 women at the meetings. And then Apple Island got so popular that space became a problem. We found ourselves separated just by a tall curtain from a play practice or a workshop or something that overlapped, and we started looking for our own quarters. And we got organized. We met in one woman's home for a whole day, and I bet you remember that too. Mm-hmm. And we hammered out a constitution, and boy, is that a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And a name, and that was a lot of work too, but it became Women in Support and Healing Wish. And we eventually, after a year at Apple Island or so, found a home of our own in a little house beside Ace Hardware, owned by Bob Shepherd of Ace Hardware on Willie Street, and got a lot of meetings going in that house. Not all, but mostly lesbian meetings. For a while, there was a Women of Color meeting. There were Al-Anon meetings. There were 16-step meetings. The basic thing about them, whether lesbian or heterosexual, that didn't matter so much, was that they were free of smoke and free of men, and neither of those things were possible in AA at the time in Madison. But then, as the history of AA has gone many places, there became more and more women's meetings and more non-smoking meetings, and the need for that space became less acute, and gradually we found it hard to raise the $700 a month it cost just to keep it going, notwithstanding a lot of spaghetti suppers and pancake breakfasts. And we had one wonderful event, the Kay Hagan weekend, mm-hmm. which my old friend Elf very ably orchestrated and brought Kay to town for an evening lecture at the Historical Society, nearly a full house. That was great. Mm-hmm. And a workshop all day at Apple Island conducted by Kay, which was, she was a feminist writer and philosopher who was really hot stuff at the music festival and very dynamic. And we all loved having her here. And then a quite elegant brunch at Apple Island. It's hard to imagine Apple Island being elegant, but we rented tables, and one of the women got a lot of nice-looking tablecloths and china and everything from a hotel, and we had and lots of flowers, and we had a very spiffy, as I remember for us, sort of pricey brunch in which Kay spoke, and we had a really good time together. And it was, I think of that as maybe the sort of culmination of mm-hmm. active lesbian time in Madison, and it involved the lesbian community and the lesbian feminist and the heterosexual feminist community all together in one sort of grand blowout. None of us ever summoned up the energy to do anything like it again that I know of. Have you? I never have. It just was, we wore out. And I didn't have such a huge part of it. I was kind of a gopher. My major responsibility actually was providing vegetarian food for Kay, because she was staying with a woman who was an excellent, excellent cook, but didn't know how to organize a meal without meat at the core of it. So I ran over vegetarian dishes during the course of things. But we all did our part, and it came off very well, and that was a tremendous event. So that was going on during those years too. And as we had to give up Wish House, and it became not necessary to have Wish House, we still had two meetings a week, one at Wilmar Neighborhood Center and one at Atwood. And maybe a year after Bee's death, I was, the other two women who had been the basic movers and shakers behind the starting of Wish had sort of gone off to other areas of their own life. One had moved physically, and one was involved in all sorts of health problems. And so I was sort of left carrying the ball, and saw that these two meetings kept going. And we started taking quite a different shape. But we did meet Tuesday nights and Thursday nights, and it seemed to have a valuable function, even though it didn't have the size or the social component, or thank God the fundraising component that we'd had at Wish House. And different people were coming in out of different needs. It was still a generic meeting that filled needs that the more traditional AA and Al-Anon programs didn't provide, and gradually evolved into a group as it is now, which is as much heterosexual as lesbian, and which is tends to be perhaps more book-based, in which the 12 steps are woven in, but not in any very clearly delineated fashion. It's sort of just background information. In fact, some of the women in Wish don't have a 12-step affiliation, which I rather regret, but I think a lot of them go through Wish and go on to a 12-step affiliation, but they don't have it when they come to us. So we have a group of typically 10 or 12 women who meet now only on Tuesday nights. Thursday night became redundant. And this fall we're going to be working with an exciting new book called Dancing with Monsters by Kate Wolf Jensen. And people can identify their own monsters, be it alcoholism, sexual confusion, relationship problems, chronic physical illness, whatever. And it has lots of exciting and creative ways of going at that, and that's our plan as we resume meetings after Labor Day. So I kind of diverted into the history of WISH, and that's kind of symbolic to me of what happened in many, many areas. A friend called me not too long ago and said she had lesbian withdrawal, and she said, what's happened to our lesbian society? They're never potlucks anymore. And as I was pondering that, she said she asked that of someone else, and they said assimilation. And I thought about it another second or so, and I said, yeah, I think that's what it is in Madison, anyway. We are so well assimilated that we don't feel the need for a separate existence as much. There's sometimes when it's fun. We have a history in common. It was very exciting to me to go to the organizational meeting of this group and hear some of the old stories about our softball teams and funny times together and when so-and-so fell in love and just all and Apple Island and all the things and places and events and concerts and the Women's Music Festival. But in the present tense, we don't have quite the same need. But meanwhile, WISH was ongoing, the Tuesday night thing, and there was a woman who'd had a lot of background in adult child 12-step work and had been technically diagnosed as an addict at one point when she was screened. She smoked too much pot and so on. And she asked me if I'd be her sponsor, and she was a woman I was interested in. I liked her history, and I liked the way she talked and presented herself, and she seemed very bright. And I said, let's meet and talk about that and see if it seems like it would work for us. I had quite a few sponsees, and I wasn't over keen on the idea in some ways, but I really wanted to be her friend. So we made a breakfast date, and we had breakfast up on Fair Oaks at what was then the Curve Diner. And as we parted, she left me with a fat envelope, and I thought, oh, crap. We didn't agree about sponsorship or not. I said I needed to think about it a bit, and so she left me with this fat envelope, and I thought, oh, good, just what I need. Now, a fifth step, I had a jam-crammed day at school with a dental appointment at the other end. Well, I shot across town to my dentist after school carrying this fat envelope, and I had a few minutes to draw breath in the parking lot before I went into the dentist. I opened the letter, and it was not a fifth step. It was a love letter. And that was an interesting perspective on this relationship, and I pondered that instead of being a sponsor. I said, well, that kills the sponsor idea. I will not be her sponsor if she's in love with me. So we had another date and talked about that. No, I replied to her letter, and I said, well, it was worth exploring. I'd planned to live alone for the rest of my life. My God, I was in my 60s. This woman was in her early 50s. B was gone. That was, I thought, the love of my life, and that was enough. I was quite successful living alone, and I didn't feel a big need to be partnered anymore. I had a good support community. My family was around and doing well, but I decided it was worth exploring, and of course I did the alcoholic thing, you know, the lesbian and alcoholic thing, U-Haul on the second trip. It wasn't long before we were living together, and we had a dire situation. We couldn't actually go to bed together right then, because I had too many people living at my house. And in fact, at that moment, I had a house guest, and I was sleeping on a single pad on the floor in the study, because everybody had all the beds. And it was hilarious. And I remember we went to a WISH meeting, and one of the younger women there looked at the two of us and said, I think you should leave early tonight and sleep in the same bed. And we managed to do that, and that was the beginning of the relationship that exists quite comfortably with its moments, but quite comfortably until this day. And what I've observed, I fell in love in the way that alcoholics do, alcoholic lesbians do, and head over heels, just like a drunk. It was just wild. We went to the music festival together not long after that, first night in bed together, and after Carol moved in here. And I remember it was still wild and woolly, and we found enormous pleasure in the lesbian culture there because we were just kind of steeped in it ourselves, and it was a lot of fun, and the music fueled that, and everything was wonderful. The food was wonderful. The tent was wonderful. The company was wonderful. The neighborhood was wonderful. The blah, blah, blah. We had a great time. And it was deeply satisfying to me because, by the way, Bea had never liked the music festival. I mean, she didn't like the idea of it. She would never go, so I always went on my own. I went to maybe a dozen of them alone. The first time I went without Bea, I went back with a bunch of pictures that I thought would pique her curiosity and get her to be enthusiastic about it. And I would have a picture of a tractor because I know she was an old farm girl and just loved tractors. And then she would notice that it had a flatbed full of naked women behind it, and then she hates public nudity, so that's what she'd noticed, not the tractor. And it had a lovely picture of three musicians meeting impromptu on a path to play their instruments. It was just a spontaneous gathering, someone with a flute, someone with a stringed instrument of some sort, I don't remember, and it was just a beautiful moment in the woods. Took a picture of them. Well, they were naked from the waist up, and she didn't like that. And then I'd take a picture of people dancing, and I would have a porta-potty in the background, a porta-jane, and she hated that. So Bea just never would go. Carol loved Michigan, and we were both campers. So that was a nice thing, to have something different and that we both cherish so much. And another thing I very much loved about Carol's life was that she owned a farm out on the edge of DeForest, where her mom lived and another woman who was just staying with them. And they had llamas and alpacas, two of each, and five goats, which belonged to the other woman, but they were all there, and three dogs and a barn cat. And it was just a delightful environment, big garden. And so we lived in town, but that was Carol's weekend place. She had to have an in-town address for her job with the city. And so that was just a great time. We worked and played and gardened and took care of the llamas, and I got increasingly acquainted with her mother, whom I loved, and almost immediately. First time, Carol invited me out to their house for the first time. That would be before we officially fell in love, I guess, because I had become a new grandmother, and she invited me to dinner, and they had a new grandmother party. And as I entered the back door, someone had built onto the house and eliminated a front door, so you drove in the driveway and went in the back way. And as I was welcomed at the door and Carol held the door open, a goat shot between me and Carol and into the house. And I thought, well, this is going to be a very interesting household. When I met Carol's mother for the first time, she was wielding a broom rather vigorously, trying to get the goat out of the house. I thought maybe she was aiming at me at first, but it turned out to be the goat. It was pretty funny, this little woman who was about 5'1", swinging this broom wildly chasing. Turned out this goat had been reared as a house goat by someone who had ultimately to give it up because her husband said, it's either the goat or me, and she gave up the goat and given to this woman. So she, Twinkle Toes, her name was, and Twink tried to sneak into the house at every opportunity. So it was just a really fun place to be. And Carol said something to me when we were just falling in love, something to the effect that, I've got the places that would be wonderful places for women if you can provide the women. She wasn't gregarious. She was not really a loner, but tended to be associate with a small group of friends and not be broadly gregarious as I was. And I said, oh, I'll find the women, that'll be fine. And she had a lovely cabin she and her mom had supervised the building of out near the Mississippi River, and this wonderful farm. And we just had natural gathering place. It was once the cabin was the scene of a large wish encampment. We had everybody out and people. I don't know if you were still involved in Wish at that point, but we had, I don't know, I suppose 25 or 30 women all around in tents and campers and sleeping on the cabin floor, and we did a kind of potluck fare. Everybody cooked, and we had 12-step meetings, generic 12-step meetings, and it was a lot of fun, very, very successful. And we had numerous gatherings on the farm, mostly of recovering women, mostly lesbians, not always, and she did. She had good places to bring people. And I, meanwhile, was expanding this house. I built the sunroom as a retirement gift to myself, and which was the same year that we were falling in love. So there was lots going on, lots of action. Yeah. And I would say that was the last big burst of, I should check notes, but I think the last big burst of purely lesbian activity. By that point, we were both old enough, so we were neither of us involved in sports anymore. we actively sought a church which was open and affirmative, but not a lesbian society there per se. We found such a church, and we both became enthusiastic members of it and still are, and it's very comfortably open and affirming. I don't think there's any place we're more assimilated than in that church, unless it's AA, my particular AA groups anyway. The church directory has pictures of heterosexual couples and pictures of lesbian couples and pictures of gay couples, and we're all just listed the way we're listed, and that's sort of the attitude there too. It's very warm and accepting, and there's no, I remember I was elected moderator, the lay leader of the church one year, and the woman, an older heterosexual woman, came up to me. She's a woman I think of as the mother of the church. She's the choir director and the treasurer and all sorts of, you know, she's one of those people as sort of the pillar of the church. And Marlene came up to me and said, "Oh, Jane, I'm so pleased." She said, "I was the first woman moderator, and now you're the first lesbian moderator." And I thought, isn't that neat? She was. She was just pleased. She just glowed with satisfaction. And here's a woman approaching 70 who has this kind of enthusiasm for that mantle being passed along. And that, to me, was sort of symbolic of the kind of reception we've had at that place. So that felt very, very good indeed. And so as I pondered my friend's question about assimilation, that was one of the things I thought of. And then I thought about assimilation in my workplace before I retired. I belonged to two very bonded teacher groups. One of them called itself Breakfast Club, and we ate breakfast together every morning, every Friday morning for 17 years before I retired, even though some had gone to other schools by then. Having in common that we started out because we were all kind of child-centered and wanted to talk about things together, and then that we just loved one another, and we went through a lot of stuff together, marriage, childbirth, divorce, death, all kinds of stuff, and became more and more bonded. We just had a meeting this last week, actually, although all but one of us is retired now. And another group called Bridge Club, which doesn't play bridge, or six of us, we don't ever play bridge, but we needed a name, so we decided that was a socially acceptable. And the other five women are all heterosexual, and the talk is all very motherly, grandmotherly, supportive. Now we're all aging, all again but one retired, and one of the women seems to be in the early stages of Alzheimer's, another has congestive heart failure, another has a husband in very dire physical condition, and I'm suffering from rather difficult arthritis and so on and so forth. So we're going into the aging thing together, but we're still very bonded. And my being a lesbian doesn't seem to be a matter for either of these groups. There was a gay man in our Breakfast Club to whom I was devoted and who was very supportive of me during the difficult time I was having with Ben and taking up with Marcia. And he and his partner left teaching, and his partner left the travel agency business to buy an inn in New England, where we all visited many times and had wonderful times. But sadly, Richard died through what was essentially medical malpractice, and Patrick lost interest in life and had AIDS and just quit taking his medication and essentially euthanized himself by not taking his medication and died here in hospice, where Breakfast Club turned up day in and day out to support him and love him. And so we had two of us who were gay out of whatever there were, eight of us maybe, and that never was a matter either. We loved Richard, and they loved Bea and then Carol, and it was just never a problem. So I felt sort of soaked up by you know, Jane, alcoholic, lesbian, and all, that I have people in support and love. What I see remaining to me of lesbian connection, of course, my relationship, the sort of entity in church, which is sort of gets a symbolic display once a year at the Gay Pride March. Our church puts out a delegation, and Carol and I don our tie-dye clothes. We have some very loud tie-dye pants, and Carol has a loud tie-dye shirt, and we ride our rather colorful three-wheel bikes in the parade, and so we've gotten to be kind of an annual part of the color of the parade, which we enjoy because we're, you know, I'm a ham, and Carol pretends she's not, but she is too. And my old doctor, who's now retired from medicine, but still very active in PFLAG, is always there to wave us on, and very proud that she has these friends. And a great many of our friends, particularly in the recovery movement, are in recovery meetings, are lesbians, and we have in common a whole lot of memories, of course. And I'm writing my memoirs, which has a big lesbian component. I'm no longer able physically, and Carol isn't comfortable either, going to the music festival. We have a real cushy camper now, but we can't plug it in there and it'd be too hot, and it's too great a distance to get to the meetings we need to get to. We aren't either of us really mobile enough, so we've had to give up on Michigan, although we still enjoy hearing stories. And every year we get a souvenir t-shirt from my daughter, who goes with her partner. So, although I don't know if she'll be doing that again. She has a new partner who has never been to the music festival before, and she found it kind of hard to take. She didn't enjoy it too much. I think there's a lot of generation gap with the music. There certainly is by me. We've been involved politically and done some volunteer work with Free Wisconsin. And we did the march. And the Wish meeting has this sort of ongoing lesbian aspect and history. It has ever been and will always be, I'm sure, a meeting where lesbians are entirely comfortable, because there will always be enough of us there for that to be almost the norm. I say almost the norm because we're half heterosexual now. Mm-hmm. But all of these people who are just entirely comfortable with, you know, a good relationship being a good relationship, or a bad one being a bad one, having nothing to do with the gender situation. So that's very, very comfortable for everybody. And your occasional lesbian commitment ceremony. Had the loveliest experience this summer of going to the commitment ceremony and subsequent reception. That was the most beautiful I've ever seen of any marriage-like situation between two women who had lived together for 19 years, well, they're not anonymous, Jan Reek and Mary Kay Brimmeyer, who had an absolutely breathtakingly beautiful ceremony at Olbrich Gardens, the beauty much enhanced by it being a perfect day in Olbrich with a fragrant breeze and all the flowers. This was July 11th, something like that. And so it was just picture perfect and wonderful music. Jan is a singer, besides having been a carpenter and now being involved in Project Home. And Jan's mother, also a singer, Jan's daughter, also a singer, and two granddaughters who are sure to become singers, one a babe in arms, sang together. Mm-hmm. And that was just a beautiful, beautiful memory. And some other good music. And coming back down the aisle, everybody sang Zippity-Woo-Dah, Zippity-Day, my oh my, what a beautiful day, and Blue Bubbles. I have just the loveliest pictures of this. And the crowd was neighbors, colleagues from work, men, women, children, grandmothers, Mary Kay's Irish Catholic family from Dubuque, and Jan's family from all over the North America, and lots of recovery people, and it was just great, just absolutely great. And then a lovely reception at Vilas Park right on the lake, and again with good music, and very representative. It bridged the generation gap very nicely, because leading into the program was a salsa band, which all the kids were having a lot of fun with, and Mary Kay and Jan have a close connection with a Latino family, and I've been playing honorary grandmother to one of their children since he was born, and they have a really close familial connection. And this was, I think, his band, and one of the kids played too. And then later on, the last big event of the afternoon was Peter and Lou Berryman for us old timers, and that was so neat because I just love them, of course. And again, it's not a lesbian context. It's just everybody had fun, and so we had a great time. And in a way, that commitment ceremony, again, sort of epitomized the best possible kind of assimilation, because they have friends of all sexes, generations, sexual preferences, ethnicities, we have one thing in common. We all love Jan and Mary Kay, and we were all there together celebrating their love, and it was great. It was just great. It felt the most purely celebratory, and it's such a gift. Even their thank you card was great. They sent a picture you'll have to look at on your way out of the two of them in their wedding gear. Probably in Olbrich Gardens, I'm not sure about the background, but with a thank you on the other side for attendance and gift. And they asked that the gifts go to Fair Wisconsin or the River Alliance, because they're both avid canoeists and sort of met around camping experiences. Or, can't even remember what the third one was. Oh, Project Home, where they both work. So that was neat, too, because they don't need anything. They've lived together in great comfort for 19 years. They have all the, you know, everything they need for their household and plenty of towels and sheets and all that stuff. So it was great. So that was, that felt like the right kind of celebration of what can be and what is with those of us who've been fortunate enough to have ongoing relationships that seem to work. God knows why any of them work. I don't know why. Carol and I look at one another and wonder sometimes. We are so different in so many ways, in our interests, our backgrounds. We have kind of strange commonalities. For whatever reason, we're both kind of churchy, although we have very different sorts of backgrounds and God concepts and roles in the church and needs from the church. But we both like to go on Sunday and like to be there and like to do stuff with it. And we both have a great involvement with two friends that became my friends through Carol, Jody and Michael, who are both blind. Jody, who's a former partner, actually, of Carol's, and in the wonderful way of the lesbian community, became a friend of mine and then got married because she's bisexual, too, and now I have a four-year-old daughter who is the love of our joint lives. We had her with us for an overnight Thursday night, and once again, it was perfectly delightful. She watched television with Carol and shared a children's story with me, and we had a lot of fun at dinner, and Emily has toys all over this room, as you see, and we're having a hands-on grandmother experience with Emily that's pure joy. We're the grandmothers in residence. Michael's parents are no longer living, and Jody's mother is into dementia and her father not very well, so we're sort of there, and it's good. It's good for them, and it's good for us, and we're delighted about that. And we don't even have diet in common. I'm kind of a health food nut, and I'm always serving meals that Carol decides are disgustingly healthy and have many vegetables that she either finds strange or doesn't like, but she's coming along pretty well. She's eating more and more things, and I've learned to skip it when I know it's something that just won't go down her throat. And her mother shares fully in our life, and she's a great joy, especially to me, because I don't have that complicated history that daughters have with mothers. Mm-hmm. And she's a very, very mentally active 95-year-old who's very impaired both visually and auditorily. She hears very, very poorly and sees with increasing discomfort. She's finding it. She's having to use a cane to walk, not because her walking per se is a problem, but because she can't see curbs and obstacles. And so she's sort of feeling with a cane almost as a blind person might. And she's finding large social gatherings difficult because of the din and so on. But she eats with us nearly every noon and sits right across the table from where I am now, and we're able to communicate. We usually have another person or two at the table. And if she's in a small group like that and we face her as we talk, she can make out a lot of what we're saying. And so she's a very rich part of our lives and very involved. And my youngest son, Blaze, staying back in town for the foreseeable future and a couple of years past, has fallen head over heels in love with Louise, and she with him, and they spend a lot of time together. And he keeps her computer working at 95, and she does email and internet stuff. But he's set things up so that she receives everything in huge letters so that she can see it. He sends her lots of stuff from the New York Times. She was, when she was able to do it, an omnivorous newspaper and magazine reader in addition to reading books. And she does talking books, but she gets her current stuff all from Blaze via the internet, and it's great. Google told him recently that he'd sent her 3,500 emails the last year. Did he know that? And he just laughed because he had some sense it was a lot. Louise laughs because she says, I hardly have time for anything but reading Blaze's emails. He sends me so much news. But she loves it. And that's just great that they have. She's the grandmother he hasn't been able to have for a lot of years, and much more suitable, really, to being his grandmother than his own biological one ever was. And she's not had a grandchild, so she's delighted with Blaze, so it works out very, very well. And Louise is very open to, her daughter's always been a lesbian, not troubled with bisexuality as I was, so it's been very clear to Louise that her only child is a lesbian and she better like it or lump it, and she chose to be okay with it, and she's been gracious about her other partners. She plainly loves me and quit her own Lutheran church of many years membership to join our church, because at that point Trinity Lutheran was not open and affirming, and she said, if I'm going to have a lesbian daughter, I'm not going to go to a church that doesn't accept lesbians' relationships, which I thought was pretty terrific, because she was in her mid-80s at the time she made that decision. And now, ironically, just this past week, the news broke that the major lesbian synod to which she belonged, the, what is it, ELCA or ECLA? ELCA, the Lutheran event. Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, I think it is, which is the largest of the Lutheran groups, is not only open and affirming, but are allowing committed gay clergy to congregations which want them. So that's pretty neat. That's kind of an indicator of where the population is going, maybe where assimilation is taking us. I don't know. Because that's not just Madison. You know, I've been attributing a lot of this assimilative stuff to the fact of our living in Madison, which is so comparatively tolerant and open-minded and liberal and so on. But that represents a lot of places that aren't that way. And it represents, I think it represents a generation that's just, or generations which are coming up differently. So it's rather splendid. And I don't know if there's anything else we need to talk about. Can you think of anything, Linda, that we haven't touched on?
The only thing, Jane, that I'd like to ask you before we end this absolutely wonderful series of interviews is you've talked a lot about where you've come from, where you are now, and a little bit about what you see for the future. Do you want to talk a little bit about you mentioned that you want to write your memoirs, and one of the themes that I've been very struck by in your life is that you have been kind of a social hub for people, regardless of whatever interests or studies or education or commitments that you've made. You've been the center of circles of people. So as you move into this chapter of your life where you're kind of looking back and writing about that experience, how do you see your role as a sage and a mentor and kind of that person who continues to be at the center of circles, sharing your experience, strength, and hope with others?
Oh, that's a terrific question, Linda, because it's something I need to define for myself. One of the... Well, I don't know if it's unfortunate, but one of the less appealing circumstances of aging for me has been a great diminution of energy. I really, really don't have much going for me after I serve dinner at noon and clear up, and Michelle, who lives in our basement now, clears up, so I can't even attribute that to my exhaustion. But I'm just tired, and I need to lie down, rest my rapidly deteriorating back, and just read, and sometimes actually sleep in the afternoon. Nap, how about that, napping? And I have small energy for evening meetings. The WISH meeting at 6 o'clock is about as late as I care to go. And so I'm not a hub of anything that involves night parties. Believe me, I'm not. I'm happy to have, as long as I'm able to sustain it, which I hope will be until my death or until I'm thoroughly demented, whatever happens first, to maintain a sponsorship role. Hopefully a role model role in sober lesbian life, because I have been fortunate to be able to maintain continuous sobriety for 35 years, and hopefully that'll go on to my death. And I am active in sponsorship, and I have an active role in the social concerns commitment, social justice, and physical missionary type stuff, collecting things for needy people and feeding homeless people, which we're involved in tonight, by the way, at our church. So, and I'm kind of a driving force behind that particular aspect of our church life. But I'm not driving as hard as I did. I definitely feel the need. Those memoirs, by the way, are written. I've got 735 pages in manuscript, and I have nearly 600 now in second draft form on the word processor, still in need of a great deal of editing, which I have a couple of volunteers for. Three, actually, which is very good. I just discovered a new and very able editor who'd like to do that. So I belong to a writer's group, but I'm not a driving force. I'm just a member, and it impels me along. I'm not eager to be a party hub anymore. We used to, this edition was made with potlucks in mind, and we have very, very few. I did have, for 3 years, first weekly, then biweekly, then monthly potluck for our AA group, and for two AA groups, actually, one at 5-11 and early risers, but the group got too large and the activity got too strenuous, so now we've moved that over to the family centers where we hold our meeting, and other people have to take charge a month at a time. I give them guidance, and that's what I'm willing to do. I'm definitely cutting back in my role there. I hope to stay available as a listener, sometimes perhaps counselor, although, you know, it's kind of ironic as you get older and feel somewhat wiser, more and more of it seems to be a product for me of my own experience and not something transmitted verbally to other people. There is kind of a role modeling thing, mm-hmm. but it's small ways, including the modeling of what I hope is fairly successful aging. I mean, I have a lot of bodily deterioration, but I am able to. I ride my bicycle, my three-wheel bicycle, to a great many meetings, and that's heartening to younger people who have already begun to note arthritic symptoms. And I'm happy a large part of the time, despite quite a lot of chronic pain, because I'm easily distracted. I distract myself from pain. And I have a lot of commitments which I'm able to honor, but I'm cutting down on the number of commitments. So I see a diminishing role in the purely, in the more social leadership aspects of it, and more to the, my life now speaks more to the, I'm picturing a, say, Native American elder stepping back to the outside of the ring, not participating in the powwow dancing anymore, but enjoying the spectacle and being glad to offer shelter, applause, whatever anyone needs who steps out of the dance for a while. And I speak at pretty regular intervals, definitely on around every anniversary and so on to an AA group, telling my story, sharing my experience, strength, and hope, because I think there's been a lot of all that, and somewhere nearly anyone can tie into a part of it, so I'm glad to share that. I've been given so much in this life by my family, my heredity, my education. What I've been given in sobriety is simply huge by the recovery society and by the whole AA non-organization, and by my dear conventional little funny Protestant church, and by friends and life. I've been given so much that I'm driven to sharing what I can. But what I can share is obviously being somewhat limited by time and energy as I age. But that's okay. I get more time for myself, and it's kind of fun. I'm having a great time with these memoirs, a great time. It's like living parallel lives, the old one and the new one, and always drawing the connections, and it's fun, as this has been. This has been a lot of fun, and I thank you for being such a terrific and blessedly uninterruptive listener. I thought the two of us would duel, but we don't. No, we don't. No. It's been fun, so I thank you for taking me on for this project.
And Jane, I'd like to thank you as well. It's been a real privilege to listen to your story and to be part of your story, so thank you.